Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and indeed my lords, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Hospital Church of St. Bartholomew the Less. We're the little sister of the Priory Church of St. Bartholomew the Great that's just up the road and which you had your annual general meeting in virtually last year. So I'm rather pleased that you've been able to experience both of the churches and enjoy both of the churches of this parish. I've been asked to give you the essential, I suppose you could say almost administrative matters, that the emergency exits are here and there. And if you need to go to the loo, I'm afraid we don't have any loos, but the hospital does, for which I'm sure much thanks from many. And one set of hospital loos can be reached by going out of that door diagonally, and the other by going out of the back door, going into the main quad and turning left, and there are directions. At the end of the AGM, and when everybody heads towards drinks, there will be the opportunity, and this wouldn't be taking place in a church if one weren't to have the moment where I say there will be the opportunity where you could give a donation to the upkeep and continued mission of this church. A little look around will show that it's a little bit tatty, that chandeliers have been nicked, that the medals on the back of one of the tombs or memorials over there got prized out, and therefore it keeps quite a lot to keep this church and its sister church up, and therefore there'll be a basket at the back for good old-fashioned cash. And if, like Her Majesty the Queen, you don't carry cash, there's also a tapping machine, which I commend to you as well. The removal of the generous removal of the chandeliers and of the medals is testament to the fact that this church is open all the time for patients and staff of the hospital. It's been in the centre of the hospital really since the hospital moved slightly just after the Reformation, or during the Reformation, and it stood here. Its parish bounds used to be exactly the hospital until about 5 years ago when it merged with us. And even now, every night, according to the last census, there are 100 people asleep in the rest of the parish and about 600 people asleep in this portion of the parish. It might be St. Bartholomew the less, the little, but it actually ministers to more people every night. And I really saw that during the pandemic, when it was one of the few churches to remain open throughout the pandemic, because it was ministering to the people in the hospital. And it was the first place where I took a service with other people, really from after the beginning of lockdown, and not very long after the beginning of lockdown, when two doctors got married in here. Married because they were afraid that they were going to die, and that was back in the days when the whole church was hosed down immediately after it. And at that point it looked like this church wouldn't have stayed open, because we'd been approached to turn this hospital into a mortuary in anticipation of the kind of casualties that were expected. After the pandemic, I can't tell you how many doctors and nurses and patients have said how glad they are that that plan didn't continue, because this church remained at the heart of the hospital in some of its darkest times. And church, parson and parsonage being at the heart of a community, is exactly what you would all know about, because parsonages and rectories are built for community. They're built for socialising. They're built to be able to be a place that people can gather and a place for the whole community, which is partially because they were funded by the community. And in 1832, I think it was, every parish had to provide a parsonage. had to pay for or build it. And they did. And now they're getting sold off by dioceses that keep the money, even though the parishes paid for them. And priests who should be living in them are now retreating behind their desks in central diocesan offices and are not in the heart of their communities. And it's my dear hope that over the next few years there might be a resurgence in the belief that priest, parson, parsonage, church can return to the centre of the communities and actually minister to the whole of their parishes, regardless of what people believe. Be there for everybody, as this church was for people, God knows what they believed, during the pandemic. So thank you for being here, and thank you for being with us this evening. And I'm delighted to, well, to invite you to stand and to sing our hymn.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and just a minor point before I welcome you all and everything. I'm sorry about the version of the hymn you've just sung. We worked very, very hard to get the right words, but one day I'm going to write an essay about how the words of hymns are constantly corrupted by hymnologists. And those were not the original words of H.F. Light, who wrote the hymn. We looked in about seven places. I found the right one at last, but too late to get it in print, so sorry for a slight bowdlerisation. It's a the sort of form of cancel culture, really. First of all, and even before I thank Father Marcus, thank you all so much for coming. It's just marvellous that you've made it through the rain and through the strike. And we were grossly overloaded with people accepting, wanting to come to this and wanting to hear Matthew. So it's almost a relief that you couldn't all get here, but because we are pretty well full. So it's welcome, and please congratulate yourselves. I'd particularly like to welcome, because I think he's come from Dorset, our patron, Sir Tom Stoppard, there at the back. Can we give him a round of applause? And our ecclesiastical patron, who has come from Wiltshire, but I know has also walked from Westminster, Lord Charters, over here. But welcome to all of you, and thank you very much, Father Marcus, for your amusing and moving words. It's very, very inspiring to think of what this church did through COVID. And I don't know if you all know, but Father Marcus is a great leader in the idea that churches should, wherever possible during the pandemic, and indeed at other times, stay open if they possibly can, and minister. And this seems to be an oddly unfashionable view in some ecclesiastical circles. So thank you very much for that. And it's lovely to be here. As he said, we were here virtually last year, which actually meant that the only people in the room who were related to the Rectory Society were myself and Robert Bathurst. I was talking about Gray's Elegy, and Robert was reading it. And that was in St. Bartholomew's the Great, so we felt a bit lonely. And it was also made more difficult for you kind members, because the sound feed didn't get through until about 15 minutes, so everyone had to wait rather when watching it virtually. And my lectern collapsed early on, and I had to hold it up for the whole rest of the disquisition. Anyway, it's particularly nice to be back here and all physically present and not virtual. Thank you. I shall, as usual, try to make my report as brief as possible so we can get on to hearing Matthew Paris. But there are a few things needed. First of all, apologies for absence in our committee. I think we're all here except for James Miller, who has a bad hip, poor chap, and is about to have it replaced. He gives his apologies. The fundamental situation of the society, thanks to your loyalty, is extremely good. I really would have thought people would have dropped away over these last 2 years, and we weren't able to offer you a very great deal in that time. We kept up the newsletter brilliantly, thank you, Ali. But you know, we couldn't meet, and we couldn't visit much. You'll remember everything from so many different stages, backward and forward with COVID, that sometimes we did get to some things, and then we it all regressed. So apart from our lovely day at the Brompton Oratory, we haven't really gathered in large numbers until this moment. I must also thank our sponsors, Castleacre, loyal from the first. Please stand up. I think Robert is representing Castleacre. Please, Barry is waving there. Please give them a big... And the other one is Ruffer, Jonathan Ruffer. And I think Jonathan is still not here. He's struggling to get here, I believe. But again, could he be cheered in his absence? It is wonderful to get this sponsorship. Our membership has never gone up since we've existed. I mean, the cost has never gone up. The fee has never gone up. In terms of getting the cash in, the sponsorship is marvellous. By the way, I don't know if people feel that we should put the... It was perhaps a silly question to ask members. Should we put the... what we tend to feel about this is that it's quite laborious to put the membership up, because you contribute by standing orders and you'd all have to change when it'd be a great bore. But we do need more money in these inflationary times. So what I think we normally do is we make more money on a good day in our visits, depending slightly on how many people come. I don't know. Is there any appetite for putting up the membership? No. Well, I think we'll continue with our policy. And the actual membership is. There's Jonathan. Welcome. Splendid. I'm very impressed and grateful. Make it. The membership figures are just tremendously good. They're just very, very consistent. And thank you, Serena Merton, for... Where are you, Serena? Yes, where are you hiding? Oh, there at the back. Yes, for all your marvellous work. And we're 652 as of yesterday, which is very much what we have been for a long time. And considering we haven't offered much, I think that's marvellous. Financial report, I would normally call on Paul Falinski, who is here, but... because we're running slightly late, so I think I will just report that everything is shipshape. Is that right, Paul?
Everything is shipshape, yes.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much. Now, and this does need some explaining. Can I ask Amanda Pansamy to come up and explain our visits? Where are you, Amanda? Yes, this microphone will do it.
I'm not very good with the microphone. Can you hear me? Well, we're going to get back to proper visits this year. Actually, Deborah Allen-Jones and Ali and Serena did organise some last year that some of you came on, which was wonderful. But hopefully you've all got an appetite now to get out and join us on some of our visits. The first visit is going to be in May, middle of May, the 10th and 11th of May, and we're going to the Isle of Wight. It's a two-day visit, and we will be starting at Carisbrook Castle, just because I feel you need the history of the island. We will then we'll go to Ventnor, where a member of ours lives, and the following day we've got a really wonderful array of Tennyson's house, Mottiston, which was the rectory for the a family at one stage, and a really beautiful rectory garden. So it'll be a fun day. 2 days, actually. The logistics of getting to the Isle of Wight, I know, might be a bit taxing, but you've all got here this evening, so you can jolly well get to the Isle of Wight. And then in June, we're going to have a visit in Oxfordshire. It'll be based around... we will start with Rousham in first thing in the morning. Many of you might know the very beautiful garden at Rousham, but there's rather a beautiful church and rectory. We'll then go on to Ditchley, really to set the scene for the next two churches and rectories we're visiting, which were both... the rectories were built by the Dillon family, who lived at Ditchley. So we will form a very nice sort of threesome visit. Then we're going to Liverpool a bit later in the summer, and then a Dorset visit, which is sort of being cooked up at the moment. And there'll be definitely those four, and if we can, we'll squeeze in a fifth. So, anyway, I hope to see many of you as you can, and spread the word. And you can always bring a friend as well sometimes. So.
Thank you, Amanda, very much. And Deborah and Ali, they richly deserve a round of applause. There's nothing more arduous than the visits. And the one other piece of excellent news is that, which was delayed by COVID, but is now... reached, not completion exactly, but the completion of the first stage, which is our archive project, where we try to properly record, have a sort of inventory of rectories. And Juliet Chadwick, Juliet, where are you? Can you just stand up? Thank you very much. Has actually completed the archive for the first one, Oxfordshire. It's all in a spreadsheet. It's not yet available to you and me, but it quite soon will be. And it's the most tremendous work, relating, having material about every parsonage and relating it to its parish church. So that's a wonderful thing, and we hope if one of these days to have done it. We thought of doing it diocese by diocese, but I think it's always going to be county by county. Isn't that right? That seems simpler.
Pius Pevsner,
yes, exactly. And in fact, we cross-reference to Pevsner in effect in this. So I can't actually offer you anything you can yet read, but I think we should thank you, Juliet, very much indeed. And she's on to Gloucestershire now. So members should always tell her about these things, and many of you, some of you, will have Gloucestershire parsonages. Please tell her anything you want to tell her. Right, I just need to check the time. Yes. Keep a watch on it. Matthew and I will stand here. If we get tired, we'll sit there, because I think you can see us if we're exhausted by our long walks to get here today. But we'll start standing. And Matthew, don't worry that there isn't a microphone there. You've got one on. It's fine. I just like to welcome, as you know, we always have a guest of honour every year, and we've had a glittering array over the years, and we're keeping up that top standard with Matthew Paris. I'm going to ask Matthew to talk a bit about himself as well as about Parsonages and so forth, so I won't go on in my introduction. He's very well known to all of you. He's quite an annoyance to me because I attempt to be his rival on Saturdays in the Telegraph, and he's doing it in the Times. And it's always somewhat humiliating for me. But he is a most marvellous writer, and I lay claim, probably falsely, to being the first person to publish him in a national publication. Matthew was already quite well known because he was a Member of Parliament, but he wrote an absolutely brilliant article, which I think he just submitted on spec when I had just become editor of The Spectator in 1984, and we called it Up the Airy Mountain. It's the most extraordinary account of Matthew and two friends sleeping the night very, very high up in the Andes, so 12,000 feet, and then they get attacked, and they sort of climb up the mountain to 17,000 feet where they can hardly breathe, and it's all very terrifying and very amusing, and I could tell right from that moment of reading this. You should know that when an editor gets an unsolicited article, it's almost always no good. It's just one of the sad facts of life. But this was marvellous article, and I just stuck it in, and ever since then he's been famous, or that's the way I like to put it. Matthew Paris, please come and join us.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Is my microphone? Yes, I think it's turned on. Thank you. Yes, halfway up that mountain, I remember thinking, what would Mrs. Thatcher do? It's often a very good question to ask yourself in difficult circumstances.
The particular reason Matthew says that, apart from being the Member of Parliament, was that he worked for Mrs. Thatcher before he entered Parliament. I think you were correspondence secretary. So perhaps we could start just very quickly, take you through a bit of your career, starting there. What did you do for her, really, and how did it work?
Well, I was really only a clerk. I was her correspondence clerk. She was leader of the opposition. I started in 1977, so she'd been leader of the opposition for a couple of years, and I did it for 2 years until the general election. We didn't have email in those days. She received, on an average, 700 letters a week. In 1 week, she received 5,000 letters, and I alone, with a couple of secretaries, had to open all the letters and work out what to do with all of them. Plainly, she couldn't read even a small fraction of what came in. We sometimes resorted to saying thank you for your views, but we tried to notice what the letter was about and make some reference to the subject the correspondent wanted to raise. It was interesting to note that almost all the letters were supportive. That doesn't mean everybody in Britain was supportive, but it meant that people didn't, on the whole, in those days anyway, simply want to write to express their dislike. They wrote to support her. Only from Wales, and that was interesting, did the really the really vituperative letters seem to come. She was a wonderful boss, absolutely wonderful. You knew you worked for someone who knew her own mind, who worked harder than you, who was in before you, who would leave after you'd gone. And there's a little story somewhat related to the time and place this evening. She asked me to put up to her every evening any letters of a very personal nature that I felt that only she could answer. I tried to be strict about this and not do it too much, but I had a letter from a lady who said, "My dear husband has just recently passed away. He was everything to me. My life seems empty without him. I am kept alive only by the belief and the hope that I shall see him again in another life. Do you, Mrs. Thatcher, because I have always admired you and your excellent mind so much, do you believe in the afterlife? Plainly, I could not reply to that letter on her behalf. It came back the next morning. She wrote the letter in her own hand to the lady. It started with sympathy and condolence, and then it came to the question. And her reply was this: Christians believe in the afterlife, and I am a Christian. Yours sincerely, Margaret Thatcher. And it struck me as almost a sort of Jesus-like avoiding of the question in a way, but in a dignified and a kind-hearted way. And to this day, I still don't really know what she meant.
I can just add to that in a way, because Mrs. Thatcher and I were both godparents to the same children who were twins. I think we were both godparents to the son. And, of course, Mrs. Thatcher has twins. So I said to her by way of conversation, were Mark and Carol baptised? And she said, absolutely mysteriously, yes, but they didn't have the water. So I'm not sure that she completely... She was in some ways very religious, but she was certainly not sacramental. Matthew, I don't want to dwell too much on this, but didn't you cause a tremendous upset when you were the correspondent, Clark?
Oh, yes. 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 I let her down badly. I had a letter from another lady, or she had a letter from another lady in Gravesend, who said, she wanted to tell Mrs. Thatcher that she didn't like her council house. It wasn't up to the standards that she expected of a council house. She didn't like the fact that there were some people on the council estate who were not white, and she didn't see why she should live in the same estate as people who were not white. And mostly, she didn't like the fact that the people next door had a child who had Down syndrome, who made a noise, and she didn't see why she should have to live next to nuisance children. It was late when I opened the letter. I'd had far too many letters to answer already. It was nearly 10 o'clock. I was tired, and I dictated the reply, which went not under her name, but from Matthew Parry's private office of the Leader of the Opposition on her headed notepaper. And it said... Her name was Collingwood. It said, "Dear Mrs. Collingwood, I'm sorry to see in your letter to Mrs. Thatcher that you are unhappy with your council accommodation. You should be grateful to have a roof over your head provided at the ratepayer's expense. Yours sincerely, Matthew Parris." Mrs. Collingwood, incensed, gave it to her husband. He gave it to his shop steward. They gave it to the trade union leadership. They gave it to the Labour Party. And the Labour Party sat on the letter, my reply that is, until the day the general election was declared. And they then printed 3 million leaflets with copies of my reply. The leaflets were delivered by a lorry driver who wasn't quite sure of the address that he had to go to, and opened the contents, opened one of the packages, and saw that it was from Smith Square, and to Smith Square, assumed that it was probably for the Conservative Party, delivered all the leaflets to the Conservative Party, and that those were days of a greater courtesy than now. The Conservative Party took them straight over to the Transport House, the Labour Party, on the other side of the road, and they were put through the door of every council house in every marginal seat in Britain. And if we had lost the 1979 general election, I would be worth a footnote as amongst the reasons for that loss. And she was absolutely furious. She called me in. She used to sit in a yellow wing-backed chair, and the carpet seemed enormously long and the room enormously wide as I walked across her room towards her chair, and she looked at me with an expression that she's looked at me with so many times, that said, there's something not quite right about this boy. And she put her head slightly to one side. She wasn't going to be angry. She was just very, very disappointed. And she just said, why? 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 And she just kept on saying, why? I retired hurt. Her private secretary, Richard Ryder, gave me 2 double brandies, I remember, immediately afterwards. And I don't think she ever quite trusted me again. But there we are.
have you just answered my next question, which was, you became an MP in the victory, which might have been a defeat, and you left Parliament actually before the election, the 2 elections after that. It came in 87 and you left in 86. Did you think you were unsuited to be a Member of Parliament in some way, or what happened?
I liked the constituency. There are perhaps some Members of Parliament among us here. You are prince or princess of your own patch. You are like Lady Bountiful. People know who you are. You can get things done for people. If they want a pedestrian crossing in a place where there's a good case, you can get it done. If they want the window frames of their council house painting, you know the director of housing in the local authority. And on the whole, a letter in those days with the on the MP's headed notepaper does get attention, and on the whole people will do things for you because you're a Member of Parliament, and basically just to keep you out of their hair. So the Director of Housing would help a bit, the Director of Education might help a little with a out of catchment placing. You could do all those things, and you get the impression that you are a mover and shaker, and that you are making people's lives better. It's a mixture of vanity and I think genuine goodwill towards your lovely constituents, and mine were lovely people in a lovely part of England. But you do realise that what you're really doing is helping those 1% of our fellow citizens who would even dream of writing to their Member of Parliament in the first place jump the queues in which the remaining 99% patiently wait. You haven't caused there to be more housing or more places in the school. You've simply helped your constituents jump queues. And you go down to London and you're really treated like dirt if you're a backbench MP. You are just the pond life of the parliamentary party. And you find, or I did, that being an MP feeds your vanity, but it in the end rather starves your self-respect. I wasn't unhappy. I laboured happily as quite a good constituency Member of Parliament, but I wanted to be a minister, and I wanted to be a parliamentary private secretary, a sort of bag carrier to the minister. That's the first rung on the ladder. And after 6 years, Patrick Jenkin, the Secretary of State for Health and Social Security in those days, Patrick Jenkin asked me if I would be his PPS, and my heart leapt. But I was about to make a speech at the Oxford Union proposing the motion that this house is glad to be gay. And so I thought, we'd never discussed this, never discussed it with the Chief Whip. My constituents, the local association, had never asked any awkward questions, thank goodness, because I should not have been able to lie, I think. And I thought, well, we'd better sort this out with the whip. So I took the speech I was going to make at the Oxford Union to the Chief Whip, or rather I sent it to him, and he said, come and have a whiskey. And I walked in, and I was served with a very large whiskey, sat down, and he said, listen, I'm going to tell you something. I've never told anybody, really, he said, I don't think, in my life. I haven't even told my wife, he said. I certainly haven't told my constituents. I don't believe in God, he said. But I don't stand up in church and shout, I don't believe in God. I've never said to my wife, I'm afraid you've married a man who doesn't believe in God. It is a question entirely between, well, you might say, God and me, he said. I'd like you to think about that and think about your sexuality and think again about speaking at Oxford. And it was meant to be kind. I do not tell this story mocking the chief whip. He meant it kindly. He meant to say, I don't really mind what you are. Just make sure that it doesn't cause difficulty for the party. Keep it to yourself. I didn't keep it to myself. Patrick Jenkin called me in and said, unfortunately, you can't be my parliamentary private secretary. And the long and the short of it is, Charles, that after 7 years, I realised I probably wasn't going anywhere. Mm.
But you immediately got offered, well, I may be getting the sequence of events wrong, you got offered the Weekend World presenter's job, and that allowed you to leave before the election.
It did, yes. I had to cause a by-election, which the Conservative Party nearly lost. My majority of 13,000 went down to 100. It would have been 99 if I hadn't gone up to Derbyshire to vote. And Mrs. Thatcher was absolutely furious, quite rightly, so that someone should leave in order to get a more interesting job. And so she never would appear on Weekend World for the 2 years that I presented it. I followed Brian Walden. And that didn't help the programme, which I led, I'm afraid, to an early grave after 2 years.
And ever afterwards, you went from Weekend World to The Times, and in different forms, starting, I think, with a brilliant sketch for a long time. That's how it began, wasn't it?
Yes, Charlie Wilson was editor and asked me to try a sketch, and I thought, what a come down. I was going to be a television star. I've been a Member of Parliament, and now I write a funny little humorous sketch for The Times about goings-on at Westminster. But I thought I'd need the money, so I started doing it, and I really loved it. It went well, and everything flowed from that.
So that's 30 years and more, isn't it?
Yes,
in The Times. Yes, marvellous. Well, now perhaps without asking you like John Henry Newman to give a full history of your religious opinions, can we get a bit of a sense of where you come at this this subject about church and belief and so on? You did a brilliant article about this recently, about the church, not so much about your own beliefs, but about the Church of England, and I'll come on to that. But first of all, perhaps you could locate yourself in this.
Well, my father, I think, didn't believe, but he never said so. My mother wanted very much to believe, and she tried Catholicism. She attended the Church of England. She even tried Christian Science for a while. And she ended up with the Society of Friends as a Quaker. And so much of my boyhood was going to church or sitting in Quaker meetings. I joined the Boys' Brigade. I have a reasonable biblical knowledge and a pretty good knowledge of hymns too, mostly because of the Boys' Brigade. I can't remember that I ever believed that any of it was true. I don't know. It's remarkably difficult to remember what you felt at the time, what you thought at the time. I said my prayers every night. I still say my prayers every night just because I always have. But I've never believed that it was true.
So Newman, I think, writes in the Apologia that it seemed to him when he was a boy that there were only two self-evidently existing beings, God and himself. You felt neither of those things, or perhaps you did feel that you existed?
I didn't trouble myself about the existence or otherwise of God. I went through the forms of religion without, as I say, I think, asking myself any questions. I've never felt lonely. I've never felt I need to believe in God. The best argument I have ever heard for theism is Bishop Butler, Joseph Butler, in the 18th century, who makes the best argument you can for natural religion. Basically, he argues that we are creatures disposed to believe that somebody somewhere is in charge and that some kind of leadership gives meaning to life. And if we are so disposed, if we have been created thus, then we should simply accept what our nature draws us towards rather than fighting against it. He expresses it much better than me. His 15 sermons are well worth reading, and that was the closest I have ever been to belief. But no, I've never felt lonely or any need for any underpinning to my own sense of morality, which perhaps I get from my parents, and which you may say is rooted in Christianity. but it doesn't need to be underpinned for me.
But I've seen over the years in your writing, which is not the same, we're not really talking about belief here, but a lot of writing about church and what churches say and the cultural effect of churches and so on. And I'm interested by your attitude, which would seem to me to be sometimes highly critical and sometimes very appreciative.
Oh,
Is that right? Is that a fair way to characterise it?
Yes, completely appreciative. Perhaps when I was younger, I used to like banging on about not believing in God, but I don't care for that any longer. You only upset people. People have their beliefs, and it's a kind of discourtesy to appear to enjoy challenging people's beliefs. I love the church, and I love the fabric of the church. I love the ritual. I love the music. I like and admire a lot of the people, and I love the sense, the collegiate sense, the sense of community, and the sense of trying to do right that the church imparts to people. I also love the person of Jesus. I can't help but love him. I was brought up to love him and to read his words, and I am absolutely certain that Jesus Christ did exist. Because if he hadn't existed and had been invented, so to speak, by the church, I think they would have invented somebody much more convenient to established religion than Jesus. He's not very convenient to established religion, and he says a lot of things that are not at all convenient to those who wish to believe in him. He is a thoroughly inconvenient figure, and for that reason, I think it's very likely that he did exist, because you don't invent inconvenient figures. And I simply, I am afraid, believe that he was under a misapprehension as to being the Son of God. But everything else about him I love and respect.
How would you characterise him, actually? I mean, the inconvenience point is very strong. Can you imagine Jesus as a character?
Yes.
What would you say? If he were alive today, what would he be like in conversation?
I think the word charisma is probably the first, that almost before he had spoken, you would have a sense of a presence. And you do all through life just occasionally meet people who you know radiate goodness in some way. You just do, and he would radiate that. I think he would be, to him, tribalism of party, of left, of right, or of sect would be absolute anathema. And I think he would become, I can imagine quite a bit of righteous indignation on his part at when Christians fight with each other, war with each other. And I am afraid that the wealth issue, the riches, the tapestry, the material fabric of the church, which I love so much. He never really mentioned any of that, and I'm not quite sure that he would be as interested in it as we are or as I am.
Mm-hmm. Do you have, you don't believe in God, but do you have a sense of God, of what he might be like, as it were? There was an old high church priest who came to retire near us, looked after an Anglican convent, and he had a very sort of Oxonian manner, and he once said, smoking his Balkan Sobrani, drinking his gin, pink gin, he said, I say, when we get to heaven, I do hope we don't have to see too much of God. As if he was sort of rather boring, overbearing professor who would come and spoil the, do you have that sort of sense that some people do of the whole idea of God as being sort of threatening or oppressive?
There's a very good sketch by Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. You're, many of you, of an age to remember those two. And I think one of them, I can't remember which. Yes, I think it's Dudley. Dudley says, "Oh, it must be wonderful to be in heaven." And I'm so looking forward to the next life. And Peter Cook says, well, let me tell you why I don't think you're right. You sit there on that letterbox, and he sits on a big red letterbox. And Peter Cook says, it's the other way round. Peter sits on the letterbox. Dudley, at the foot of the letterbox, Peter says, now praise me. And so Peter starts saying, you are wonderful, O God, I praise you. Carry on, praise me, praise me more, praise me more, praise me all day. And after a while, Dudley says, yes, I don't think heaven will be quite as interesting as you were.
In this column you wrote recently in the Times, which was my specific, was always a good reason to ask you, but that was my specific reason to ask you to come and speak tonight. What you wrote was a sort of challenge to the Archbishop of Canterbury, and indeed the hierarchy at present, not unfriendly, but you were saying, I think you were sort of saying, why spit on your luck? Why are you so embarrassed about the sort of church you've inherited, and why are you always trying to make it completely different? And why are you so worried about what people believe, when belief is a very odd and difficult thing to talk about? Shouldn't you accept that these people are here for a reason, and that it means something?
It's rather like the disagreement I have with the bosses at BBC Radio 4. I do a programme called Great Lives, where I invite someone who has some public stature, and I ask them to nominate somebody no longer alive from any age whom they admire. And I have in the audience, but not the audience, I have in the studio an expert witness, and we simply talk about the life. And I am under constant pressure to appeal more to younger people and to appeal more to the kind of people who don't listen to Radio 4. I'm rather keen on appealing to the people who do listen to Radio 4. And they are interested in great British explorers from the past. They do want to hear about Florence Nightingale. They have an idea of great men and women, which might be a bit stuffy, might be a bit old-fashioned, but it is their idea. And I don't want them to keep tuning in and hearing about people that they haven't heard of and don't really want to hear much about, simply because younger people, or the kind of people that don't listen to Radio 4, might be interested, because I don't think they are anyway. And the church, I think, faces a long and difficult century in which it may be in decline. It may be in slow, gentle, persistent decline. I don't think it should panic and abandon the people who still belong to it in order to try to bring in people who have not chosen to belong to it. I think you stick to what you believe in, and you stick to the people who believe in you. It's not that you want to be unwelcoming to outsiders, but you have to remember that the people who have supported you through thick and thin are the core of your support, and you have a responsibility to them.
And the point you made developing from that is that the people who come may not actually be believers, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't matter to them.
Yes.
I want to say a bit more about that. What is the Anglican temper in that way?
Well,
because you were talking about the Church of England specifically, it wasn't Christianity in general.
I would struggle to give a general definition of the Anglican temper, but it includes a great respect for tradition, for ritual, for buildings, for beauty of music and architecture. And many of the people who have that respect will also have a strong, perhaps even a passionate belief in a deity. Others will be quite doubtful about it, but still love the Church of England. And I think the Church is custodian of beauty, stewardship of beauty and of architecture, and of music, and of ritual too, can survive a measure of agnosticism, and we ought to accept that.
Do you think, one thing I sort of possibly disagree with you about is that it didn't seem to me quite right to say that Anglicans don't believe
something, though that may be true of many of them. Isn't it more that they don't want to sort of shout from the housetops, and they don't want to assume they're right, so that the belief is very private, possibly quite vague, but more like that? Do you see? I mean, the Church of England doesn't have a long history of unbelief. Its history of unbelief is relatively modern, whereas its history of sort of moderation is quite old.
Yes, and as Queen Elizabeth said, no window into other people's souls. I think there's something very... It's rightly is it called the Church of England, because there is something very English in the temperament that Charles has just described. I'm never quite sure when people say religion and politics shouldn't be mixed. I have the feeling that religion has things to say that do have consequences in politics, and that one can't entirely or shouldn't try entirely to disentangle them. But certainly modesty, discretion and respect for the privacy of other people's beliefs is not only an important part, I think, of the Church, but something that I very much respect myself.
I think you said in the article that you say your prayers, and I've often read this in opinion polls or surveys, that far more people say prayers than believe in God. Which is interesting, isn't it? Tell us about how that works.
Well,
simply... Who are you asking, as it were?
I don't know. I've no idea who or whom. Well, I do. I don't think there's anybody listening to me, but ever since I was a little boy, taught by my mother, I kneel by my bed, and I go through a list of brothers, sisters, uncles, aunts, or family, friends, relations, spreading outwards towards the wider world, and ask God to look after them all. I can't believe that it's without meaning, even though I don't think anyone's listening, you know what I mean.
Yes. Well, thank you. We I think it's probably reaching the time we should throw it open to all of you and get questions directed at Matthew. I'd just like to say in passing that what a marvellous programme. I'm sure many of you are in the Radio 4 target market and do listen to Great Lives. Matthew once kindly invited me to go on about onto it. And I was very pleased to do so. And I mention it because, apart from simply that Matthew does it so well, is that the person I went to talk about, it's interesting, a sort of example of the type of person Matthew finds, was a marvellous leukemia doctor called Gordon Hamilton Fairley, who was a doctor here at Barts and was blown up by the IRA. Some of you older people will remember this, because he was living next door to Hugh Fraser, the politician, husband of Antonia Fraser, and his dog smelt under the car and the bomb went off and killed Gordon. So it was very nice to talk about Gordon many, many years later when one fears he'd been forgotten. And we had a lovely conversation with Matthew and the family.
I remember Charles saying that when I was little, he said, my little friends were his children, and you all played together. It's great to imagine the great, and I mean it, the great biographer of Margaret Thatcher as a little boy playing with his little friends. And Charles, there was just one thing I wanted to, an idea I wanted to plant, if I may, because a question might not arise. And that is that it isn't. This is a failure, I think, not just of Christianity, but probably of Islam too. And for all I know, because I don't understand Judaism very well, of Judaism, that we are enjoined, as Christians, enjoined to believe that we have the same responsibilities to everybody, that we love our neighbour as ourself. Who is our neighbour? Our neighbour is everybody. The Good Samaritan parable teaches us that. You cannot actually live your life like that. You can only live your life with concentric circles of obligation. The first obligation perhaps being to preserve your own life, the next, your family, your children. It spreads more widely to your neighbours, to the larger community. It spreads to your country. And it does not stop anywhere. It does proceed towards the whole of mankind. But you do not have or feel or ever can feel the same sense of moral obligation to a great many people that you don't know as you feel you have towards those whom fate has, so to speak, cast in your path. And I'm not clear that the Christian teaching, certainly not Jesus himself, ever really gave comfort to those people who are troubled by the fact that if it were any friend or relation of theirs begging in the street, they would immediately stop and help them and take them home. But if it's no friend or relation of theirs begging in the street, they don't have the same obligation. I always feel slightly guilty about that, and I ought not to feel guilty because it's inevitable. And it would be nice if Christianity had a bit more to say about that.
It's a very interesting point, isn't it? I suppose one way of thinking about it might be to say that suppose Jesus hadn't said that, what would happen then? What would, how much less good example we would have of how we ought to approach other people? It's a yes. counsel of perfection, which will yes. not be fulfilled, but it's a very important thing to say.
Yes.
Is that?
Yes.
Thank you so much. Now let's have questions from... Sorry, I shouldn't have answered that. The bishop, I should have asked the bishop to give the give the answer. Perhaps he, I hope he will. Questions, please, ladies and gentlemen, to Matthew. Yeah, gentlemen there. There isn't a roving microphone. You might want to stand to make yourself more audible.
Yes.
The way you talk, it always seems to be like a talking paradox in all the different situations.
I don't know. I actually like paradox. I think some people sort of shy away from paradox. I get a positive thrill from noticing two opposite things that appear to be true at the same time. I don't know why. My father... There were two things my father always said that got on my nerves because they were true. The first was stop making an exhibition of yourself, and the other was stop contradicting. I like contradicting and I like contradictions, and I have ever since I can remember speaking. I can't explain it.
There's a good career in it, which we both follow.
Yes.
Another question, please.
In a little talk, which is a very complex society within London, and it's about a question about the future for the Church of England. And the church in Solihull, the director is actually gay, and he changed the church completely over 8 years since I know him. Because before that, they were losing the congregation because nobody was there anymore, because nobody was welcome. And 2 years ago, we started what he calls in his private house. It's called Faith and Food, where he invites people to discuss, where he has also a speaker from another parish, and then they discuss things about faith. And all the people there, and that is surprising, so in the parish of Seoul, 50% are not from Seoul. They come from other parts of London, or even further away, because they feel welcome, because they're transgenders and everything. And my question is, our society is so complex these days, and I wonder what's going to happen to the Church of England if all these people are not going to church anymore, we do them anymore. How can the Church of England be so negligent of these young, very young people in these circles of discussions? They are very young people. I mean, young people are very interested, I was very old in that circle. And that's my question, where the future is of the Church of England, regardless of these complexities of society, especially when it comes to faith.
The man you describe sounds a warm, open, charismatic person, and charisma is something almost impossible to define. And there have been bad people who were charismatic as well as good. He's obviously one of the good ones. But for the rest, for the thousands of, hundreds of thousands, millions of churchgoers, and for priests and parsons and vicars and curates, most of them will never be possessed of those charismatic powers. And I don't think they're neglectful of the rest of society or of young people or of the different kinds of people who don't come to church. I think they just genuinely don't know what to do to bring those people in. And I think they try. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But I wouldn't characterise the Church of England's stance, as it were, as being careless or neglectful of the fact that there's a wide mixed society that doesn't always find its place inside church. I think Anglicanism understands that very well, agonises about it all the time, and genuinely doesn't know what to do.
Thank you. Any other ones? Yeah.
Do you think politicians make for better politicians if they have faith of anything? Do they not need
faith? The trouble is, I could think of politicians whose lives and whose politics has been informed by faith, and it has been very important to them, and it has been entirely a force for good. But I can think of people with very strong religious beliefs who have been hardened by those beliefs, or twisted even by those beliefs. Look at Northern Ireland, for instance. So I'm afraid I can't give you a general answer to that question, but I never disagreed more with Alistair Campbell than when he said, "We don't do God." Tony Blair, I don't know him very well, but his faith is real. There's no question about it. He knows it has not been an asset to him in politics, but he believes it anyway, and he doesn't really try to hide it. And I cannot but believe that that is a good thing.
Yes, by the way, it was an interesting thing about Tony Blair that I think he was really a Catholic much earlier, but felt that he couldn't become a Catholic while he was Prime Minister, on the grounds that the British still don't really like Catholics, which, by the way, I think is true. The curious thing now is that we have now got a Catholic Prime Minister, because it turned out that Boris Johnson is Catholic, which shows that it is a very inclusive church.
Well, forgiveness is an important part of things.
Right at the back there, thank you. Yes.
Well, I think the stewardship of its buildings rests first in the hands of the church. But if we reach a situation, and I agree with you, I think we have, where upon the relatively narrow base of the church's membership, all this great network of beautiful buildings cannot be supported alone, then I think the state should move in. I think it's in Spain, where voters can actually say whether they want some of their taxes to go for the maintenance of Catholicism, Catholic churches, or not. I wouldn't mind it if we were allowed to say whether we mind it or not, and then no one could complain that they were being taxed, as it were, for something they didn't believe in.
I think we've probably got time for one more question. Yes, that gentleman against the pillar, yeah.
Churches.
Thank you.
Not at all. And I also think there should be no note of despair in what you say. That spirit is alive all across England. I live in rural England. It's very much alive in parishes in rural England. It's not dying, and perhaps we should recognise it with rather more enthusiasm, as you suggest.
Can I just add a supplement question, because it's relevant to all of us here, Matthew? You said that you thought Jesus wasn't all that interested in the fabric and the wealth and all that sort of thing. And, of course, we have to admit that in the Rectory Society we are rather interested in fabric and wealth. And, indeed, the most beautiful rectories that we go and see tend to have been alienated from the church now, and they depended on money, obviously, to be built, and a certain social standing of large parts of the Anglican clergy. Do you think that is an obstacle to, or was, to religious practice in a good way in parish life, or do you think actually they helped?
I think I would need to be a better historian, a better church historian, to know, to be able to answer that. Should any of you ever be in the Peak District where I live, almost the nearest village to me is called Birchover. Walk into Birchover, you will see the most enormous old vicarage, it's called. It has chimneys galore. It must have 7 or 8 bedrooms. It's a beautiful, magnificent building, very much in the old rectory sort of style. Not far from it, and somewhat in its shadow, is a very small church, which was Birchover Church, still is Birchover Church. And I did think to myself, I know that the Birchover village could not, and the church could not in its collection box, support this vicarage, let alone the vicar, now. But I wonder whether they ever could. And I wonder whether there isn't the roots of a little bit of a problem.
I think we should bring it to a close, because it's important that you can all have a drink, celebrate this wonderful evening, and meet Matthew. Matthew, just before closing, I'm particularly pleased, I'm sure many of you were, your comparison with the question of Radio 4 and the audience. This thing, it is a nightmare if you're in media where you're told that you must do something for young people, regardless of whether actually there's any hope of attracting their attention. And we used to suffer from this a lot in my long career in the Daily Telegraph. And at one point, the message went out, I was deputy editor, but unbeknownst to me, the message went out that we needed more obituaries of young people. So I wrote a letter to all foreign correspondents to encourage them to go and get killed in action. So we could have some. It is a real curse. It was lovely to hear. It was lovely to hear you stand up for the people who actually like the programmes, or as it might be, the services or liturgy which are provided. It was an absolutely marvellous talk, or rather discussion, and I entirely endorse what the gentleman over there said about Matthew's kind spirit and his ability to live with paradox. I'm sure we've all enjoyed that very, very much tonight, and we can unparadoxically and warmly thank you.
Thank you.